Good morning, dining and travelers, particularly those of you crossing the pond to the Olympics in London. We're bringing you today on the menu with Ann and Peter Haig, another revisit in a different category of where you might eat when you're in between watching all these sports.
Hotel restaurants, good restaurants in hotels, fine restaurants in hotels, is quite a new thing, I think, for London. In fact, one of our interview guests said when he was invited to become the chef, it was because they wanted their restaurant to be like a restaurant, not like a hotel restaurant.
Right.
And I think over the years, people have been very critical, but there are two sides of this development which are interesting. And two of our interviews today represent this, and then two represent the other. In one model, the restaurant says, we want to own the hotel, but we are going to make it a fine dining restaurant. And we have two in that category, the Littleton at the Stafford Hotel by Kempinski, and a restaurant called Quillon, and a sister, in fact, an older sister restaurant called Bombay Brasserie, which were established by a large Indian-based, that's India, the subcontinent, Indian-based hotel chain that has properties around the world. And then a different model, and also a very common one, is that in order to have a fine restaurant with a fine chef, the hotel will come to an arrangement where they lease the space and the restaurant is actually owned by another group of people, possibly the chef, possibly not, but someone else actually runs the restaurant, even though it's located in the hotel. In all four cases, interestingly enough, in the entire model, there's something extraordinarily convenient about being able to go back to your hotel in the evening and have dinner there and not venture forth again. And that was something that we certainly enjoyed doing when we had dinner at the Littleton. Anyway, starting off today's program is a chef who would have found himself in fine company in last week's category of French restaurants, but he also happens to be in a hotel, Bruno Loubet.
I love this restaurant. Yeah. I love Bruno.
And he returned. His history is very interesting, but let's, without ado, get to the program, because we talk all about that in the interview.
I think on this trip we could just not get enough of wonderful French food, which is certainly a bit different this time around. Today we're at Bistro Bruno Loubet, talking to the chef proprietor, who's, of course, Bruno Loubet. And Bruno, you've moved around a bit here, and you've covered a lot of continents. Let's have a brief summary of your background. You were born in France. Where?
Yes, I was born in Libourne, which is a city outside Bordeaux, not far from Bordeaux, really on the middle of the vineyard, you know, Saint-Emilion, Pomerol, Fransac. And yes, I was born there. And at the age of 14, I went to the catering school in Bordeaux, in Talence, done 3 years. And from there, I started to travel around Europe and work my way in different restaurants, like in Paris, in Brussels. And then I ended up in London to work for Pierre Kaufmann at La Tente Claire at the time.
Oh, so that's who you were?
Yes, that was my start.
You were also with Raymond Blanc.
Right? Raymond Blanc, yes. I'd done 3 years with Raymond Blanc, a year at the Manoir and 2 years at the Petit Blanc, which at the time was a different restaurant of the Manoir, but not like the Brasserie Blanc now. Some maybe a bit upmarket. Yes, I've done 3 years with Raymond.
But then you did something kind of exceptional. You had a young family, a wife and a young family, and for benefit of a different lifestyle, you picked up everybody and moved to Brisbane, Australia.
Yes, that was quite a move.
But it was a big move.
Yes, but you know, after Le Manoir, after working 3 years with Raymond Blanc, I went to London, and you know, I worked also 8 years, I think 7 or 8 years in London after that, and basically done very well, but burned myself out, and I start to, like many chefs, to be a bit depressed and tired and want to change and everything. So we look at all alternatives, and you know, we thought it was quite exciting to go to Australia
it
and
is.
Have a try.
Yeah, I mean,
which
really
we did, and he ended up to be very nice, you know.
And you had your own restaurant.
Yes, so we arrived there, and basically the idea was to change life, on a different level, because Working in London at the time was to be competitive on the market. You know, you work up 200 hours a week, and basically you end up to pay a mortgage and the school for the children, which is what you had to do. But then I thought maybe there is a better way to control your life. So when we look around and we realize that selling our place in London, we could afford to buy a house and the restaurant in Brisbane.
Yes, exactly.
And start a new life. So that's what we decided to do, and we just have a go.
And it was a French restaurant?
Yes, actually, funny enough, the restaurant I find was always been a French restaurant.
Oh, really?
And it's funny because it's a restaurant I heard about many years ago, before going to Australia. It used to be called Le Saint-Emilion, which is the area where I come from in France. So it's a lot of correlation there, which is a bit bizarre because, one day I was walking around in a street I was doing at the beginning when I arrived there to try to position everything and maybe find a restaurant. And then I come across this little place with a beautiful little garden and a wooden house with three little rooms, nice little kitchen, and you know, so, oh, that's a, you know, like a dream place for a chef. And then, I talked to the proprietor, the chef proprietor, and a week later I bought the place.
But you lasted 8 years, you said.
Yes, 8 years. And eight very nice years, I have to say. You know, Australia is a fantastic country. Brisbane is have a lot to offer, much more than people think. You know, they think,
yeah,
this is a country town. Well, it's not really a country town. It's a very modern town now, and they're getting bigger and bigger. You know, I think something like 1,200 people move every week to Brisbane. So
the whole of Australia is very different from when we lived there. I mean, everything has exploded now.
Yes, and the food scene is pretty good well. You know, there is a lot of excitement.
Used to be horrible, though.
Yeah, yeah, but
now
they catch
it's
up
really
very quick.
Yeah. Now, okay, so what motivated you? If that was all fun and successful, why did you decide to come back to London?
Ah, that's a big one. Well, I think, firstly, it was the idea of my wife. And as you know, wife always convinces you to,
wouldn't
this is the right
French
idea. Yes, she's French. And, you know, she wanted to come back because family and missing the family. And we thought as well that if we don't do now, then after it will be too late and we will never come back and maybe regret. So we thought, well, let's have a go and maybe for 5 years, and we can always come back if things don't work out or, you know, if, depending on the situation with the family and everything. So we decided to have a trial, and we come over, and everything went extremely well, you know, with the restaurant and everything. So looking to go back for the moment.
Uh-huh. So everything's going well here. And you've worked with some really major chefs, but you've also been able to see the big momentous change in dining in England and in particularly London. I was interested in your pop-up restaurant. Tell us about that.
Oh, that was actually Monsieur Pierre Kaufman pop-up. And that was nearly 3 years ago now. He was for the London Restaurant Week, which was organized by the Evening Standard. And it's quite a big thing in London. You know, they do a lot of things in different restaurants, but they always have a major event every year, a different major event. And that year, they decided to pull Mr. Kaufman out of his retirement. And as we know, Pierre Kaufman used to have three Michelin star and a fantastic restaurant in London called La Tante Claire.
Yes.
So, which I worked there because that's
there,
my first job in England. And
that's one restaurant we've never been to, right?
Where Gordon Ramsay is now.
Yes,
oh, right.
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah, that's where I go. That's where the three-star Gordon Ramsay is.
So how long did this pop-up last?
Well, it was supposed to be for 2 weeks, 10 days, and they ended up to be 2 months because it was so successful.
Londoners seem to like that. I mean, they flocked to that the Thomas Keller one in Harrods, and that was really expensive.
Very expensive, but very popular as well.
Yeah, I mean,
so
it was sold
out. I think people
see
it as a chance to do something they may not be able to, you know. Instead of traveling to America, they are there in London, and they say, why not, and just go for it, which I think is nice.
Well, now, this hotel, your current bistro, is in the Zetter Hotel,
yes,
which is a very smart, hip place at this time,
yes,
right?
Yes. The Zetter opened, I think, 7 years ago. And they've always been very popular. They won a lot of awards for design and for
it's the. It's a design hotel, isn't it?
Yes, as you say, it's a hip place. But also, it's the staff is very pleasant, and you know, there is no. It's a really pleasant place to stay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's.
And it is the kind of place that you expect a French restaurant, which actually that. Let me ask you before this. It used to be that all the great restaurants in London were French. And then it went out of fashion. Now, back here, I mean, we've been to a number, Italian and French, but French seems to have made a major comeback here. Do you see that happening?
Yes, I mean, definitely in London.
And why?
Well, because I think, you know, it's like everything, you know, everything doing well end up to have excess. And maybe French food in London for a while was maybe a bit boring and too expensive, and so people start to look at something else and discover other things. Now, if the business is going away from you, you have to bring it back, and to bring it back, obviously, you have to change. And I think a lot of restaurants in London now are very much aware of what people want and are excited about. And so you have to put yourself in question all the time and look what's happening around the world and look at, for start, I would say, look at what people want to eat and enjoy to eat. And what
but
kind
the
of
people eat, they don't really eat the traditional heavy cream-laden
No,
French
that's why.
Stuff.
I think all this have changed a lot, and now French cooking is more exciting and probably as exciting as it ever been, you know, because obviously a lot of chefs now are looking at all the techniques and the products and what's happening around the world and try to incorporate in French cooking to give a bit of an edge and more excitement.
And your style is sort of a modernized, lightened French.
Yes, at the bistro, I try to keep the bistro feel, keeping things simple. On the menu, you always will recognize some, you will always catch some appellation which people feel confident with, you know, like boudin blanc or snails or daube de boeuf or things people can relate to and know is part of the French bistro style. But at the same time, you know, we try to give a bit of excitement, so a little surprise. So, for example, the boudin blanc, instead of coming traditionally with a cream mushroom sauce, say, which is traditionally way, at the moment come with fresh peas and wild garlic and things like a little stew. Petit pois à la française, which is also a classical French dish, but make it lighter and very green and very fragrant and very tasty, reflecting also the season.
We are here. Luckily, this is the debut of this new menu today.
Yes, actually, we changed the menu today for the spring.
This and what are some of the stars on here? What are you going to recommend that we have for lunch?
I think the boudin blanc is actually a great example because it's very much a classic French dish, which in the past used to be eaten only around Christmas during the month of December.
It was
very much a dish for the... You know, for this period, but now you know you can have all year long. But here, I actually put on the menu when we opened the restaurant 2 years ago, and I never been able to take it off. So what I do every season, I change the garnish. Look, now it's spring, so I put a little peas and wild garlic, which are at the moment in English countryside. And in summer, I may change again and put a little ragout of summer vegetable. And then in winter, you end up with cassoulet beans or something like that, you know. So I basically change the garnish, but keep the boudin because it become a bit of a classic here. So some people come to eat the boudin blanc.
What else must we absolutely try?
Okay, the snails. I think the snails are really, really good.
Is this the one with the meatballs?
Yes.
I don't understand that. Tell me about that.
Okay, so the story goes, I mean, actually on the menu, I call it snail morissette. Morissette was the name of my mother. And so I dedicate this dish to my mother because actually it's based on the dish she was doing at home. So she used to stuff the shell of the snail with the snail inside and a bit of Toulouse sausage. Mince.
Oh, really?
And cooked in stew in a tomato sauce with red wine and mushroom. And we used to love to eat this. We have a big bowl on the middle of the table, and you know, we eat with your finger. You know, you suck the shell and everything. And And obviously I couldn't do that in a restaurant because it was a bit too like family style. So I kind of refined the dish, changed it a bit, put a little royale of mushroom instead of the mushroom in the sauce, try to make the sauce a bit more balanced, and my mother wouldn't agree, but perfect it. And and then he became a hit straight away. I mean, he was a big hit, and we have a lot of article about and everything. And actually, often when chefs come to eat here, they have the boudin and the snails, which is funny because they always seem to be attracted by these dishes. So, yeah, they are really good. So the little meatballs basically are a refinement of the Toulouse sausage, which was pushed in the shell of the snails.
Well, there's so many things I have no idea how you go about. You have bouillabaisse, you have assorted fish. The grilled marinated quail look good too, with the blood orange, because it's seasoned for blood oranges, right?
Yes, it's seasoned for blood orange, so we use it in the dressing and also in little segments with this kind of a few leaves as a salad with a quail. The breasts are marinated with citrus zest and olive oil and lemon thyme, and then grilled. The legs are minced with a bit of chicken liver and duck heart.
Wow, and then, nice light dish.
Yes, and then we use a little bit, and we do, with a quail egg, we do a scotch egg, which we serve. So it's a bit of, you know, fun little salad around the quail, which is nice. Actually, it's quite light for this season.
Well, I'm really looking forward to this, and I don't want to keep you much longer, because you have a lot of questions being thrown at you in the kitchen about this brand new menu.
Boiling and waiting for me to about that.
Well, I can't wait to try it, and we'll talk to you again.
Okay, thank you.
And Bruno, thank you so much. Good to meet you indeed.
Pleasure. Have a good lunch.
Did it sound like we thought we were going to have a good time?
Well, we sure did.
Well, it sounded like we were going to have a good time, and we did. And I think lunch finished around 3:30 in the afternoon. But it was fun to meet Bruno. It was fun to really enjoy his extraordinarily fine food. As an amusing aside, as we mentioned during the interview, Bruno worked for several years for a famous French chef who settled in England, and himself will own up to the fact that he reinvented British cuisine in the 1970s, Raymond Blanc. And we did not, unfortunately, have the opportunity to go back to Bistro Bruno Loubet that night when Raymond was going to be among the diners. But we did ask Bruno to say hello, and I'm sure we'll catch up with Raymond again ourselves very soon. But in the meantime, now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and staying, of course, with our hotel restaurant theme, we move on to the Littleton at the Stafford, which we stayed there. We enjoyed the place very much, and we certainly enjoyed the restaurant.
We did. We did. We enjoyed, well, Peter enjoyed a tour of the wine cellar with sommelier Gino, and Chef was out for the night. We had dinner there, but his team did an absolutely magnificent job, and we caught up with him fresh back from vacation on a Monday morning, and had a nice time talking to him, and I'm sure you'll find he's a down-to-earth but a very interesting character, and we won't hold it against him that he's from the enemy of Peter's native Yorkshire. He's from the Red Rose County of Lancashire, but we won't hold that against him because he makes such wonderful food. So here's a representative, Ursula of the Stafford by Kempinski, and then Brendan Files, the chef at the Littleton.
Well, one of the nicer stays we've ever had in London has been here at the Stafford London of the Kempinski chain. It's our second Kempinski, and we've loved both of them. Talking to us about the hotel and also then about, obviously, the menu and the food side of the operation. First, we have Ursula von Platten, who is the hotel's PR director, and then we have Brendan Files. Ah, I got it, Brendan. Who's the executive chef who recently redid the entire menu when he arrived. He's been here only about 17 months, you said.
Yeah.
Let's just get a little perspective on this hotel. I was telling you, I am crazy about the artwork of the hotel, but there's more to it than that. Ursula, tell us a little bit about this.
Well, the hotel itself is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. So it is part of an old townhouse. Then we have a new part, the mews, where we are currently, and we have old stables, which are now forming the carriage house. And all three parts have been individually designed. So the artwork which you see in the main house has been done for us during the last renovation, which was last May. And so it has been commissioned for our hotel specifically. The artwork which you see here and the mews, where
well, you
also staying.
We didn't commission the Picasso.
No, we didn't finish the Picasso, but we had somebody really looking very carefully.
It's a splendid pig I've ever seen in my life, with almost a single line defining it.
So, no, we are very happy that we have very different and distinct parts of the hotel, which obviously reflect also where you are. So we are very happy to be and very proud to be a British hotel. And you can see it in every corner of our hotel that we are extremely proud to be British. So all the produce which we're using in the hotel is sourced in England. Brendan obviously is our latest British import to London. So he will make sure that all the food which we have on the menu is basically British. And that also goes through to the American bar as well as our wine cellars, which you have seen. Our wine cellars date back to 380 years. And have been used by us for now nearly 40 years.
Well, now, is it recently acquired by the Kempinski chain?
Kempinski is managing the hotel now for 2 years.
2 years, okay. So they're just the managing organization?
Yes, Kempinski is a managing company, so the hotel is individually owned. And even with the takeover of Kempinski's management, the whole staff has stayed on. So
well, that tells you a lot. Yeah.
And it is a Mary Poppins hotel, so you can see it. It's a very British feeling to it. And it is, while most of our staff stays here for a very long time, I think the longest staff member is here now nearly 45 years.
Wow.
And this makes it very special. So our guests recognize our staff and vice versa, obviously.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah,
and it has a homey feeling to it.
It does. We know most of them by name already.
Yes.
And we've only been here several days.
Absolutely the most amazing thing, because we are probably 400 meters from Piccadilly Circus, probably the noisiest place in London. This place is incredibly quiet. To say you can hear a pin drop is no exaggeration at all. The only sound that we can hear is the sound we're making right here.
And, of course, we're in one of your prime rooms, this penthouse suite. But it has a terrace.
Yes.
In good weather, that would be just wonderful.
Well, you have now one of the first nice spring days. So to have breakfast outside, you should make the most of it, yes.
That's a good thing to do, to order room service and have breakfast outside.
Definitely, if you have the penthouse suite. Also now when the weather turns nice, the American bar has an outside part in the mews, which is absolutely fantastic in summer. So the warm days, it's packed out there. People love it to come for lunches or for dinner as well and drinks. And we use it now because we have the Diamond Jubilee coming up for the Queen. We will have
a lot coming up. Yes.
Well, we have the street party then in the mews.
Really?
Where Brendan is doing a barbecue.
Can be fun. Mm-hmm.
So
he's doing a barbecue.
Yes,
we're doing a barbecue for that. I'd like to come back for that.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the food a little bit. We had dinner here last night, and just absolutely marvelous service. Again, we had more fun with your sommelier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He loves everything he does. I've never seen anybody so happy in my life. But tell us, how should we do this, Brendan? What was the menu like before you came, and what did you do to change it?
I think the menu was a little dated before I came. I came from a more restaurant background. Whereas the hotel, the chef here before was a hotel chef.
Yeah,
and they wanted to update the menu. A lot of the things weren't probably English or traditionally English. And although we have some dishes on that are not of English origin, we use things that are produced by people in England or Great Britain. So everything. So the scallops with the Indian spices, the spices are made up actually in Ireland from some friends of ours. So just because we're serving British food doesn't mean to say we're just doing British dishes.
Okay.
You know, there's a little twist on quite a few of the things.
Right. And the restaurant is called The Littleton.
The Littleton.
And that's named after?
It's named after the first people that lived in the...
In the main house.
In the main house.
Lord and Lady Littleton owns the main house. And when Lord Littleton died, Lady Littleton worked for Queen Victoria as a nanny for her kids.
You're kidding.
So, yeah.
Wow. And that goes back a ways, huh?
Well, that was in the 19th century.
I never knew that.
That's interesting, yeah.
See? Things you learn.
Yeah, there you go.
I have a family photograph of someone that my family claims as a relative that was a lady in waiting. The Queen Victoria, and they had something they rescued from some great fire, which is a belt that sits on the top of your head that's so small, so they must have had good, strong corsets. what all did we have last night? I'm trying to...
Oh, you had the English brown crab, classically dressed with homemade mayonnaise.
That was a revelation. I did not know that you had... Crabs that size, I mean.
No, it's we try and keep that one to ourselves. No, English crab, I must say, is absolutely fantastic.
And it's wonderful.
We don't do a lot to it. We boil them per size. A 2 kilo crab would probably boil for about 11, 12 minutes. And then it's just freshly picked and served with homemade mayonnaise. And it doesn't need anything else, you know.
Oh, no, it speaks for itself. Wonderful.
Yeah. You also had the homemade black pudding.
Well, now, what did you put in that? Because you had things in that.
Yeah.
That was not your standard old black pudding.
No, that's another thing we have a little twist on. There's a tiny bit of orange juice in there. Because, you know, like a lemon, orange is a flavour enhancer as well, really. So especially with pork produce or lamb produce, we'd use a bit of orange juice. There's a tiny amount of chilli in there. And then something that we call a gastric, which is a reduction of vinegar and sugar and raisins. So that all goes in there, and then we actually use a powdered blood here, just for health regulations. So
a what?
A powdered dried pig's blood.
Oh, yeah. I never even thought of that.
Yeah. Well, just for health regulations, it's a lot easier, and, you know, it's quite hard to buy and keep fresh blood in England now, so that's how we
I
do
see.
It.
I see. And never come yeah. to me.
It takes about a day and a half to make, but, you know, we make it probably once a week. And then also there's lamb sweetbreads in there, which is something a bit different, which you wouldn't normally get.
Yeah, we love lamb sweetbreads.
Yeah, yeah. And that's nice. That's just served with a little, which, as it says, cider's braised apples. So we just bring some cider to the boil and then just braise some apples in it and just very slowly mash them down. Finish it with a bit of rosemary and some wild mushrooms. Yeah. Do you have a thing you had that's very seasonal, which actually... I was on vacation last week, so when we came on the menu this week was new seasoned asparagus.
Oh, yeah, right.
Again, is a great English pleasure that we love asparagus here. You know, we celebrate it as long as we can now. We'll celebrate it the whole season. And something that you didn't see that's on the menu today is the Jersey Royal potatoes. So we just got the first crop of Jersey Royal potatoes.
See, all the stuff I eat, I mean, I think my favourite food, if somebody would ask me, is potatoes.
Yeah. Well, Jersey Royals are obviously from Jersey, and they're grown in their seaweed beds.
Oh,
it's a very special
potato,
a very kidney-shaped white potato.
So we should have remember to get some of those.
We should have them on the menu before lunchtime today, probably. But that's something that just came in season over the weekend.
So people knock on your back door, do they?
Generally, no. I mean, people will have a text or email me and say, we've got the first crop of asparagus, or first crop of potatoes, or first spring lambs here, or yeah. So we just do it like that, and then we just... It helps the menu as well. You're selling produce when it's at its best, and because it's in season, obviously the cost is a little less than what it would be when it was out of season.
Right. And we had lamb.
You had lamb chops, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I've said... I only had half of them, and I said at breakfast time, wouldn't I love to have that extra lamb chop for breakfast? And that's special, too, where you get the lamb.
Yeah, Elway Valley Lamb is in Wales, actually. It's a very, quite a small producer. They do supply to a lot of the top restaurants in London now. We also buy a bit of beef from them, but the lamb's very special. They look after it very well. It's a family-run business, and, you know, something that we appreciate a lot, really.
And you do a lot of special events, I gather, huh?
We are doing, yes. I mean, we have the Sellers So we'll do wine tastings in the cellars. Or,
yeah, that Peter had the tour of the wine cellar.
Mm-hmm.
And as we had so much fun with Gino because he knows he's a master sommelier. Yeah.
It's great for us because we get to try all the wine.
Well, he knows it. And we had some really unusual ones, too.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in particular you'd recommend that somebody should absolutely not miss on your menu? A signature, maybe?
Well, the black pudding is sort of a bit of a signature.
Yeah, I would think.
Although we change the dish with the seasons, I think the scallops is really nice. Scallops with the Indian spices is a really nice dish. There's quite a few things. As you said, the crab, you know, is so English. You know, I think that has to be eaten. At the minute, probably one of the best sellers is Reggie Johnson's corn-fed duck.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, which, again, is a small producer up in Lancashire, which is where I'm from, and he actually was the first person to produce corn-fed ducks in England. He did it many years ago with quite another famous chef. So he's somebody that I've used ever since I've been cooking. You know, a personal friend as well now. So he has a really good produce. So we just roast the breast very slowly. And then with the legs, we braise them down and we make a little sausage roll, which is very English as well, you know.
Yeah, people love sausage, I know.
Yeah, and obviously just because it's in season, we serve it with the pomegranate, which yes. Lightens the whole thing up. It's very nice.
Mm. Well, there's this variety, there's consistent high quality. I think you've done a remarkable job and slosh it all down with a lot of really good wine. And because it's so quiet, you could then take a long nap. Well, we've really enjoyed ourselves, and I thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And, welcome, yes, thank you.
Yeah, and looking forward, any tip on, is it difficult getting a reservation? Somebody wants a reservation here?
Not if you know the right people.
Okay. All right, then. Till the next time, thank you.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You very much.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and our next guest, actually, the chef was taking his night off the very first time since he opened the restaurant, which was something like November.
Right. So we met with him the previous afternoon in order to make sure we had an interview to bring to you, so we were previewing the meal we had, and I have to tell you that it was every bit as good as Alan Williams, the chef, had suggested. The restaurant is called Alan Williams at the Westbury. The Westbury is located at a very chic intersection of Bond Street and Conduit Street.
Very, very smart place.
Right in the middle of Mayfair, one of the richest, ultra-chicest parts of London. The restaurant fits right in, and the cuisine is innovative, to say the least. Here's Alan.
We are in the most handsome restaurant space, talking to the chef proprietor, Chef Alan Williams. And Chef, it's a gorgeous space. It's very comfortable, very elegant, and I think you have food to match, right?
I hope so. I certainly hope so. We spent a long time organizing the restaurant and getting it to look as it does. So.
Yes. You have a background. Well, first of all, you are British. You are London-born and bred and trained. You have a background of working with a whole bunch of really impressive, important, and well-known chefs, right?
Yeah, I started working for Gordon Ramsay back in 1998 and worked in several of his restaurants over those years, including Petrus, Royal Hospital Road, and then went back to Petrus a few years later and carried on through until it was Marcus Waring at the Barclay.
Do you see people coming in here spending, what was it, £44,000 on wine?
I only wish. I'm waiting for those people to come back. I think those days are long gone, though.
I think they've got fired is what I think.
I think the expensive counts have been relinquished.
I think so. Anyhow, now this is new. How long has this been opened?
So we opened on the 28th of November last year, so we've only been less than 4 months now.
And it's your first very own, totally you restaurant.
That's right, yeah.
And in your mind, what is it you get to do here that you've never been able to do anyplace else.
Call the shots, firstly. I think this is a realization of a dream, not just about being able to be my own boss in my own kitchen and call the shots in the kitchen, but to be able to realize, or at least be able to make real my visualization of what good hospitality is and how I think a restaurant should be run. I've worked in several amazing restaurants, all been run superbly well, and I've learned an awful lot from them. But then I think every restaurant has to exude the personality of the man behind it, or the lady behind it, depending. And that's what I do here. So I made a very conscious effort to make sure that the service was exactly how I would like to be served and what I want, would like in a restaurant. So we're a formal restaurant with a formal service, but a very friendly service. Lots of personalities. I wanted to make sure that the people that I employed...
The people are...
Absolutely. Very, very important to me. The people that I employed weren't stereotypical kind of robotic fine dining front of house staff. That they've all got really very individual personalities. They're all very passionate about what they do, and they look after our guests how I want them to look after them.
Now, what about the food? Which
you were going to say the food is more important, but
no, I'm not. I'm
in
not
my list of that. Priorities, I think the food probably comes below good service.
No, I think the atmosphere and the service comes before the food, but you do have to have the good food.
Needs to. I think they need to be able to help each other out. They need to be on equal footing.
Now,
absolutely.
Would you say you're French-based, but modern British in style?
It's a difficult one to pigeonhole, I think, yeah. The route back, if you were to take a line back, it would definitely be planted in France. I was going to say Italy. But we do have influences from all over the place. I use a lot of influences from Italy, but also from home. I would say 90% of my ingredients are British.
You've got such a great larder here now, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've got great producers. We always had great producers, and we always had great ingredients. It was just making sure you could get them in London, especially. We were more or less shackled to the London markets. So if you wanted fish in London, you went to Billingsgate. If you wanted vegetables, you went to Covent Garden. You were more or less, your menu was determined by those facts. But now, and a lot of the stuff there was imported, by the way, whereas I now have, out of all of my suppliers, I only buy from two London-based companies. Everything else is further afield. Most of my, more or less all of my meat come from individual farms.
So you have direct connections to the producers
and growers?
Yeah, I do.
I
see, actually, in your menus that you credit where the products come from, right?
I either credit the people they come from,
right,
occasionally, but definitely, certainly the areas. The areas and the counties that they come from.
Now, run us through. I'm looking at one menu here that has a vegetarian tasting menu, a non-vegetarian, I guess you'd call it, tasting menu, regular tasting menu. And then you have two a la carte menus. And then you have a dessert menu. And then you have a lunch menu. So it's
a lot of menus.
You love menus?
There's a lot of menus. Scary.
So, take the vegetarian tasting menu.
Okay, well...
You said your wife's vegetarian.
That's
so
right.
I think know what you're doing with vegetarian.
Yeah, vegetarian menus seem to be becoming more popular now anyway. I think that my reasoning behind it, I always promised my wife that when I got my own restaurant, I would put a vegetarian menu on, simply because I used to take her out to all these nice places. She would invariably have a green salad, maybe asparagus, usually in the winter as well, and then a risotto to follow. And that was it. There's very little choice, and I was always disappointed for her that she couldn't get food that was equal to the food that I was eating in these nice restaurants. So I promised her that when I opened my own restaurant, I would remedy that. And it's something that I've endeavoured to do.
This stuff's so interesting, but I don't understand. I don't know what half of it is. I mean, what's crapaudine beets?
Crapaudine beets. If you Google crapaudine beets, it will come up that they were the first recorded beetroot known to man. May not have been called crapaudine at the time, but it was the genus crapaudine beets. They're a long beetroot, the original beetroot, basically. And there is,
long.
They're long. They're shaped like a wide carrot. Yeah. And they are documented before Christ. So
crapaudine beets. Do you do a lot of food R&D? I mean, you research on it?
Yeah, a little bit. I think it's interesting, isn't it? And it's nice to know.
Yes. I'm sure I should know what a Roscoff onion is.
A Roscoff onion is a sweet red onion.
Oh,
so there's so many different types of onions, and that's one of the types.
But, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's really, this menu is interesting even for somebody who's not a vegetarian. We are going to be tomorrow sampling your tasting menu. What are you going to especially recommend? I mean, it's right there because that's what we get.
Well, I recommend you eat everything.
Okay. What's this? Are these oysters, Orkney?
So we have, I like to be a little playful with the menu, but with the wording on the menu as well. The menu is very seriously conceived. It's, you know, everything I believe works really well together. There's some interesting elements to it, and there are some elements. Sea beets. Sea beets is a sea vegetable. It's a vegetable that you find on the coastline. Quite a coarse leaf, but when it's wilted down, it's got a beautiful flavor. It's quite an intense flavor.
Well, listeners, I mean, you have to really have a look at over these menus. I mean, here's one: glazed wild pigeon, chickpeas, hazelnut, lovage, a lovage fritter, and spices. Now that really gets your taste bud. I mean, you really want to know what these are.
So that actually goes on the menu today. This is the first day that this is on the menu. I change the menus reasonably often.
Really?
I think, and especially now that the seasons are changing, I let the season govern what comes on and what goes off of the menu. This dish is kind of inspired from Morocco. In fact, it's quite Moroccan in flavour.
I guess so, with chickpeas. Yeah.
The chickpeas are...
And you have Moroccan spices in there?
Well, it's actually an Egyptian spice, which is close enough to Morocco. It's a spice mix called douka. Which
I know what douka is, right, yeah.
So many different flavours in it. It's absolutely lovely. It's got a little heat, but it's very, very aromatic. But what we do is we make a beignet from the leg of the meat. So we take the legs from the pigeons and we braise them and we add douka to them, and then we make a little croquette from that.
Well, you seem to be very creative with this. You know, you spent considerable time as a pastry chef, you said.
I did, yeah. I spent, well, my formative years really were spent working in pastry. I think I had that sort of feminine touch, maybe. Or maybe I was just too slow. I'm not sure. So I seem to end up in pastry quite often in my formative years. But then I spent I spent nearly months running the pastry section of Gordon Ramsay Royal Hospital Road, which was...
That's my favourite Gordon Ramsay.
Which is his nicest one.
That's the flagship.
Yeah, it's the flagship, the three-star, yeah.
But you would expect, since you have this pastry background experience, to have some really knock-your-socks-off desserts. I'm looking at the dessert menu, which is, there are interesting things on it. What do you view as sort of like a signature? You have some, like tiramisu, Nutella brioche, which is Italian-inspired, right?
That's right. I would probably choose tiramisu as a condemned man's last meal. I love tiramisu, so
Adrian loves it too.
And Nutella brioche is, you know, one for the kids, really. But I think probably our signature on the dessert menu would probably have to be a walnut whip. And if you brought up in England, you know exactly what a walnut whip is.
I was not.
No, I can tell.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I know what a walnut whip is either, but I had a deprived childhood, so that's probably the reason why.
Maybe you were too far away from the local corner shop. A walnut whip was I was brought up in the 70s, and a walnut whip was quite a luxurious candy that you bought in your sweet shop.
Really?
Basically, it's as you buy it in the sweet shops, it's a vanilla fondant, which is then wrapped in enrobed in chocolate with big fat walnut stuck to the top of it.
Sounds really.
Oh, I think
it was really nice.
I think the difference is in the 40s and 50s when I was brought up.
No walnuts.
We didn't have those things.
Well, maybe not, but I bet they were around soon after that.
No, I think you did something very crafty when you came over here. I'm always like to talk a little bit about the wine program, and I have a feeling that I read that you managed to bring one of your colleagues with you.
Well, I brought my restaurant manager with me.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. There was nothing crafty about it.
There's nothing crafty.
Nothing crafty at all. He'd left. I was working at Marcus Waring at the time.
Right.
So previous opening this restaurant, I'd worked as Marcus's head chef for the past 5 years. And Giancarlo was restaurant manager for, I think it was the previous 3 years.
This is Marcus Waring at the
Barclay
Hotel.
That's right.
Is he, like, he does a lot of consulting, but is he at a singular place now?
Well, I believe he's there. He always was. Yeah. That was always his.
He's a bit of a current god. He's viewed as a bit of a superstar these days.
He's having a major comeback.
He's a very talented man, and he's a very successful chef.
Sure he is. But tell us about wines, because we're going to have some of those tomorrow. I'm fairly sure.
Well, I hope so. When we designed this room, we had more. This is the wine room.
Yeah, we're sitting in the.
This isn't the wine room.
Oh, this is not.
No, this is the private dining room. Okay. The wine room is in the main room, and it's basically our wine cellar. Okay. So we have most of our wines stocked in there. But what I wanted, when I sat down with the designer initially, I said that I wanted a wine feature in the dining room, and I'm thinking of the back wall possibly being a wine cellar as such that you could open and have your wine stored there, possibly with wine preservation systems involved in that as well. And what we came up with in the end was actually a small private dining room. So we have the wine cellar, which is a room. So we have fridges that open on both sides that house just over 600 bottles of wine. So we have more or less one of each and on the list.
And what is
actually in there? Well, bit of everything, really. I mean, I'm not really the person to ask about the wines. I get involved, but only in a very amateur way. I'm not by no means an expert about wine. I leave that to the restaurant manager and to my sommelier, who worked for Heston Blumenthal before he came here. So he's a pretty good sommelier.
Well, he can match wines to Heston Blumenthal's food. I guess he's pretty good.
You would think, and he does a very good job matching the food, matching the wines to mine. But what we've done is we've created a wine room. So we've created a table for eight guests inside the wine cellar, surrounded by the wines. We always lock the fine wine doors when we have people in there, just
just in case.
Just caution. Yeah, risk assessment.
People can get pretty wild after they've had a few.
They certainly can. Yeah. So. But what we do is, and what we came up with was a similar concept to a chef's table, but we thought it'd be fun to turn it on its head. So we encourage our guests to choose their wine before they come. Uh-huh. And then I design a menu
around the wine.
So if we have the opportunity, we'll taste the wines together. If not, he knows enough about wine to be able to tell me the characteristic. And then we will really focus on those characteristics, and we'll design a menu that is really very sympathetic to the wines that we think
different from what you're very much cooking.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that almost always I'll come across
if you're interested in having the eight seater table in the wine room, essentially you get your own menu.
You get a totally bespoke menu.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
And usually a menu
that's an interesting view of the world.
Well, you're very low-keyed and genial, but I'll tell you, I can tell from looking at this menu, there are quite a few surprises coming out of your head and your kitchen. What do you think we're going to be most surprised about tomorrow?
I'd say the thing that you will probably be most, I really hope everything. I think that every course on that tasting menu has an element of surprise, and I think every dish on that menu is you can be surprising, but you also need to have dishes that are rapid. I think this is what dining means, to finish thinking, do you know what? I really enjoyed that meal. The flavours were amazing. They were great. The textures, everything was great. But it has to just be simply appetising, I think, in the first place.
Oh, yes.
But there are certainly surprises on every course, and I think that you'll surprise something that will bring a smile to your face.
Really?
And this is what I like. I like people to sit there with a smile on their face.
So you can't tell us, because that would be giving away the secret.
I can tell you if you want me to tell you. I think flavour-wise, I think the first, assuming you're going for the non-vegetarian tasting menu, which you could possibly do both, which would be quite an interesting combination, and that often happens. We often have people who eat meat and fish that come in and have a vegetarian menu. The first course on the tasting menu on this one, which is the French onion consommé, crab, gruyere, potato, wafer, is very small, but it packs a punch, and it's something that's quite surprising, because we have a beef and onion consommé, a French onion consommé. We have a little layer of brown crab meat, a little layer of white crab meat with some Lyonnaise onions through them. Then we have a beef cheek on top of that, but very, very fine slice of beef cheek that's been glazed.
That's on the vegetarian menu, right?
That is on the vegetarian. Can't wait and see.
A little bit of beef cheek on there.
Can't wait to see what's on the main menu. the opposing dish on the vegetarian menu is a cauliflower panna cotta, which is, again, packs a bit of a punch.
And that's wonderful.
It's
yeah.
quite a.
I like that.
I think it's a very flavoursome, but it's delicate too. It's got, you know, I think it's got a feminine element to it, but I think it's very nice.
There's
nice
a strain here. I mean, you have sea beet, you have beach vegetables. There was a nut, sea radish, sand carrot. You're going to the beach soon.
We do. Well, I use a lot of it. Again, in vogue is a lot of the foraged vegetables and the
right.
foraged herbs. A lot of people are using them, but I think this may seem unfair, but use them kind of indiscriminately. They're there, so they use them. Rather than actually focus on what they are and focus on their character and their flavour and match them, pair them properly to an overall dish. I've been using foraged vegetables now for over 10 years, and I have a gentleman out in the north of Wales who's been supplying me for more than 10 years of foraged herbs and vegetables, who I still get my foraged stuff from. And he's made these little terrariums in the dining room as well, which you'll see later on, which are small sections of Welsh forest floral.
And
the Welsh coastline.
Well, Alan, this has been a pleasure, and we're looking forward to sampling it all tomorrow.
It's a pleasure. Not at all. It's been a real pleasure.
And we'll be back after another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, we're back for our final segment of this week's program, and an intriguing interview coming up next, because the man that we're talking to, in this case it was just Peter, because Peter crossed London from one side to the other by underground in order to make this interview, but he not only has the job of running one fine restaurant, he actually has the job of running two. One of them, Bombay Brasserie, was founded 30 years ago as a first attempt at a fine dining southern Indian restaurant, a project of a hotel group based in India but with properties all over the world called the Taj Group. Then 20 years later, about 10 years ago, they opened a fine dining southwestern Indian restaurant featuring cuisine from the region of Kerala, K-E-R-A-L-A, and that's at 41 Buckingham Gate, very close to Buckingham Palace, and right next door to an apartment hotel owned by the Taj Group called 51 Buckingham Gate. So that's why it qualifies as being a hotel restaurant, just in case you're trying to figure that out. And I'm going to try and pronounce his name correctly, and I'm going to do very poorly, but it's Sriram Iyer. So Sriram Iyer, welcome to the program. Here's Sriram talking about Bombay Brasserie and Cuillon together. On the Menu is in South Kensington, I think. Am I correct,
Sriram? That's correct.
But we're in India. We're pretending as if we're in the coastal region of Kerala or Goa or somewhere like that, because I'm interviewing the chef and manager of two, not just one, but two wonderful Indian restaurants here in London. Please explain.
The Bombay Brasserie has been in business for 33 years, and it is the first the Bombay Brasserie was opened in the 80s to actually bring to London the real Indian food, because London at that time had a lot of Indian restaurants, but we thought that it was not represented correctly the way Indian food should be, and that's how the Taj decided to do this restaurant.
Now, just as a quick point of reference, the Taj, you mentioned they're one of the world's largest hotel chains.
Taj is the largest hotel chain in Southeast Asia, and we also have hotels outside India and outside Asia. For example, we have hotel in, for example, the Pier in New York is a part of the Taj. The Compton Hotel in San Francisco is. We have hotels in Dubai, Mauritius.
Do you have
Maldives.
A hotel in London too?
In London, yes, we have a hotel and a service apartment. 51 Buckingham Gate is our service apartment. That is where Quillon is located, which is a one Michelin star coastal southwest coast restaurant, serving food from the Kerala, Karwar, Goa region, and it's a one Michelin star. Incidentally, that is the only southern Indian restaurant in the world to have a Michelin star. So
now, you distinguish that as southern Indian versus Indian from other regions of the country.
That's correct, because the thing about India is as you travel, firstly, there is distinctive difference between east, west, north, and south in terms of food. But even in those regions, as you travel every couple of hundred miles, you'll see the food styles change. So actually, when you eat across India, you can almost feel like, for example, when you eat in the north and let's say you eat in the south, you can almost feel like you're eating cuisine from two different countries. That is the kind of difference it is. It's not marginal, but huge.
But of course, there's enough land in India, there are enough people that it would qualify several countries anyway.
Yes, it will. It will qualify for many, many countries.
We interviewed someone for our program who wrote a recipe book that was, I think, 700 curries of India, or 700 recipes of India.
That is like tip of the iceberg, I must say.
He said it started out at 1,000, but the publisher said I could only have so many pages.
So that is true. So when we did this restaurant, and we called it the Bombay Brasserie because Bombay is the melting pot of India even today, and it was relevant then, it is relevant today. So people from all over India came there because that is where, or it is like the New York of America, or it is like the London of the UK, mm-hmm. So everything happened there. So different cultures, different communities came in. So it was the melting pot of cuisines, culture and all that. So it represented. And also there is a great street food culture, which is very unique to Bombay. So we wanted to represent all that at the Bombay Brasserie, and that's what we have done.
So that's as distinct from the southern Indian finer dining of Quilon.
Absolutely. They are completely different. And when we did the Quilon, again, we said, once we did Bombay Brasserie, there were a lot of them who started doing serious North Indian food because they saw there was an opportunity. But then we said, again, when we wanted to do the second restaurant, let us do something that is new but that is relevant. And then we said, let's do the South Indian food. And that's how we did Quilon. So, again, it was to show what is real West Coast Southern Indian food. And that's how Quilon came 12 years back. We opened it in 1999.
Now, did you open it?
Yes, I was part of the team that opened.
Okay, great.
The restaurant.
And you oversee both restaurants today?
I do. I do oversee both the restaurants, yes.
So you're not a busy man at all.
I just kind of, yeah, I try and do. It's fun. It is enjoyable. And London, I always say this, that New York and London are the cuisine capitals of the world. There's okay. The most serious food happens here of all cuisines, and it is interesting. So you don't compete just between a cuisine. Indian restaurant is not competing just with another Indian restaurant, but you're competing with all other cuisines because everybody has taken the level of operation in terms of food, service, everything to the level that is
I think you're absolutely right. Now that same thing hasn't really happened in New York yet.
I would want to believe that no, New York has also become very serious. For example, in New York, I remember when I used to visit it 15, 16 years, 17 years back, maybe Indian food was almost non-existent. They were there. But this what I call the Sixth Street curry houses, you know. But now you can see that some serious restaurants are opening
there
up.
There are a couple of people. There's one called
Devi.
Devi. And then Mahir Jafri also has a place.
So,
but famous chef Danny Meyer, who's a great, highly successful restaurateur, he had a
tabla.
Indian restaurant called Tabla, and it's...
But it was not Indian.
It's also the only restaurant that he
ever
closed.
But he never wanted to call it Indian. He called it modern American.
No, he didn't call
it
that.
He did not want to believe that he ran an Indian restaurant. So, yeah, it was an interesting restaurant, but I don't think it was serious Indian, personally.
Do you know Floyd?
Yes, I know him very well.
He's a lovely man.
He's fantastic. He's a great chef. He's excellent in what he does. And now he runs North Grill, which I believe is very good and is doing very well.
We've heard about it. We can't wait to go there.
Yes.
But we were so disappointed. I remember asking him once at the James Beard Awards. I said, Floyd, what will you do if the sixth time you're nominated, you don't win? He said, I'm going to take them all down. but Indian has always had a place in London cuisine all the years since I lived here, which is
but also the reason is
years ago.
There is a historical reason to it, isn't it?
Go ahead.
There is an association between this country, the UK, and India, which goes a couple of hundred years back. So there is a reason and relevance to why it is much more matured in terms of its recognition than it is in America.
But you made a huge change in introducing a different level altogether.
Yes, I think a lot of chefs here have done a very discerning Indian food and very interesting take on Indian food, which is very interesting. And
It's a pleasure. Like I always say, if you wanted to eat good Indian food outside India, the only place you could eat is London.
Right. Right. Now, I've heard of, and I can guess that's true, and it's because of that historical connection, I feel sure.
Absolutely.
Now, what kind of people come to your restaurants?
At the Bombay Brasserie, we have celebrities, as in we have stars from Hollywood, Bollywood, we have politicians, we have diplomats, we have sports personalities.
So the name really has recognition across
yes,
the city.
Yes, it is kind of, it attracts musicians, it attracts people from the theater, so it attracts all, and also obviously it attracts executives and bureaucrats and all
so
of them.
So the name is just really
people.
Very well established.
Yes. Bombay Brasserie is kind of a very recognized brand, it's a very recognized restaurant, it has a history to it, and people know. And in terms of Quilon, again, it attracts, because we are close to the House of Commons, House of Lords, so we attract people from there. We attract, because we have this wonderful hotel and service apartment which is owned by the Taj. Next door, we get a lot of executives, bureaucrats.
People who are staying at that kind of place anyway.
Yeah, so we get a complete, and also the beauty of both the restaurants is we get people from all over the world. So it's an internationally visited guest list.
Now, I'm going to sit down to have dinner with him in a little bit, but I haven't seen a menu that I really studied very carefully. Give me an idea, and therefore our listeners an idea of what you think I might enjoy this evening.
See, for example, we have a very good selection from the tandoor, which is the Indian style barbecue. For example, we do very traditional tandoori chicken. At the same time, we also do chicken kalimir, which is with black pepper, and a chicken with black pepper. Or we do a prawn, which we marinate with raw mango, you know, so the sourness of mango comes through. At the same time, we also do in the curries traditional dishes like a Rogan Josh or a chicken tikka masala. And we, at the same time, also try and work, do something with a duck, you know, we do a duck masala. Now, the idea is when we do, for example, a Rogan Josh, people say, oh, we know what it is. But we think that it is most times not done the right way. So the idea is not to surprise somebody with saying, oh, you know, look at this thing you've never seen before. That's not the idea. But the idea is to tell you, here is the real one, done properly. And what we spend a lot of time on is to get our ingredients right. So we make sure the fresh produce is the best that you can buy, cut the correct way, absolutely good quality, lean meats, you know, wherever, best vegetable, fresh. So the whole idea is even the produce has to talk. So it is like dishes that you may seem that you're familiar with, but I would like to believe that we would like to do it and cook it and
just
serve
so
it
much
in the
better.
Best.
Yes. And the curious thing, maybe I'm wrong here, but I have heard from other people, including people who cook the Chinese style as well, that if people in India or China, if they were fortunate enough to get some protein, it perhaps certainly wasn't the very best protein, so one of the things that they did with the spices was to make sure that they did something about giving it a good flavor, even though it didn't have one starting out. Now, would you subscribe to the fact that some of the recipes for Indian cuisine came from the same kind of source?
It is very difficult and complicated to generalize cooking because, for example, if you look at North, you know, the kind of cooking, there are two kinds of cooking there. And when I'm generalizing, because when you start going specific, then I think we'll spend a few days discussing.
Sure,
but to largely say there is a home-style cooking that people do where, you know, Indian meal is always a balanced meal. When I say that, what I mean is, you know, they would have a protein, they will have carbohydrate. And sometime when they can't afford to kind of make too many things, for example, they will do a fish curry, but they will put in some vegetables into it and, you know, make it a sauce with spices, stuff like that. But also largely many of the dishes also came because a lot of invasions and rule of the kings happened in a big way in the north of India, you know, from the frontier and that. So you had different rulers at different time, and there was this whole culture of wanting to impress the king. So it was very grand meal and so on and so forth. So sometimes when some of the rich meal that you eat is out of those inspirations. But at the same time, if you go to the south of India, you will see that the cooking styles was more inspired by temples, you know, so it was more of light, vegetarian and things like that. And the whole concept of non-vegetarian came much later into the history of Kerala, and, or for that matter in South, and it was more because of religious invasions and so on and so. So whole concept or the whole inspiration of how the cuisines developed on either side of India is very different, and so the approach and the way you eat and the way it is done is very different. So you'll find the food in South much lighter, simpler, and also South has, for example, the best peppercorn came from Kerala, the best cardamom came from Kerala, and so on and so forth. So you kind of had, and the best chilies came from the South and Central part of India. So, you know, there was a lot of spices already readily available, and all that reflected in the food.
I remember Floyd told us once, he came into Pittsburgh, our home city, to cook for a fundraising event. He came all the way right. into Pittsburgh to do that, and he cooked a shrimp recipe that was developed in Goa.
Correct. That but must be the bal chow.
But it was designed to cook the shrimp so that you would have it during the time when you couldn't eat the shrimp from the ocean because of the monsoon.
That's so a prawn bal chow.
To go fish.
Yeah, it is like a pickle. It's supposed to be pickling the...
Exactly. And he reproduced that for like several hundred people. it was quite delicious.
Yeah.
Now, here's the last subject I want to cover, which is a little bit tricky for a lot of people. Selecting a beverage to go with spicy food can be sort of challenging. How do you approach that at Bomba Brasserie in Quillon?
I see. Okay, that's a good question. Okay, and also it is relevant when you say Bomba Brasserie in Quillon, because see, Bomba Brasserie food is much
it's different,
more.
Yes, it's different.
Yeah, it's different. It is barbecue. It's got a little more oomph on the spices. A little more bold, broad in terms of the approach, you know, and there's lot more onion and tomato than you would have in the, and because of all the, and also the spicing is a little more stronger than Quillon. And so here, for example, I would say, for example, I encourage people to have wine or beer. For example, if it's a beer, I think a IPA, India Pale Ale kind of okay. beer works beautifully. Or even some of the beers done, and for example, America has got such wonderful beer. For example, if you look at the Brooklyn,
Brooklyn
Brewery, you know, my friend Gareth, he has done some wonderful beers right. there, which goes beautifully with food. Same thing with Goose Island, you know, they have done some wonderful.
Yeah. I heard somebody once told me that champagne or beer were the only things to drink.
So yeah, I would say there are some beers that there are also some wine that you can do. For example, if you got some of the, again with Bombay Brasserie food, if you got some of the wine like let's say a nice Shiraz, not you know, or if you did slightly semi-dry white wine,
mm-hmm.
it works. But with Quillon, the food is much subtler, so. Interestingly, I have seen lighter beers work with it. In fact, I do a 5-course and 8-course beer and food menu at Quillon. And, or a nice Pinot Noir works with that food, or a nice Viognier works. So it also depends on the kind of cuisine. So it's, I mean, the style of cuisine that comes out of India. So it is very important to know what one is eating and then decide. So yes, you can drink a wine or a beer with the food, or a champagne for that matter, but it's about what kind of dishes you're ordering, like any other cuisine. I mean, it's like...
Okay. So the smart thing to do is to ask the server, really, to say what they think will go with this particular dish.
Absolutely.
Rather than trying to guess.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, it's been just a pleasure to speak with you. Help me to pronounce your first name and last name again.
Sriram Aylor.
Sriram Aylor from Bombay Brasserie and Quillon. And the websites for your two restaurants are?
www.bombaybrasserie.co.uk.
Okay.
And www.quillon.co.uk.
That's Quillon. L-O-N. Just one L. I would have thought there were two, but there's only one.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us on the menu. And now we'll check out some food. We'll check out some beer and wine pairings.
Thank you. I hope you enjoy your meal.
I'll report back later.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for talking to us, and I hope you enjoy your meal. Thank you.
And that's all for this week's program. We'll be next week's program will be Why London Loves Italian. So don't forget to listen to us then. Join us same time, same place. And until then,
bye-bye.